Ahoy, Mets fans. Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome to episode 297 of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. My name is Brian Salvatore. Thank you for joining us today. So this episode was recorded at the end of last week, but due to a number of unforeseen circumstances, it's just coming up now, so we apologize for that. However, the only real bit of news since this episode went live is the Zach Wheeler shutdown, and we will get into that in great detail next time. So first up, Chris McShane and Allison McCaig are going to talk about the David Wright news, and pretty much just the David Wright news, since that is obviously the biggest thing going on in the Mets world right now.
Greetings, Mets fans. We're here on Amazing Avenue Audio, throwing you a curveball last week. Neither Allison nor I co-hosted, I think, if I'm correct. I wasn't on the episode at all, but Brian's got the week off. Allison McCaig is here with me, Chris McShane. And we're here to try to walk you through, what's going on with the Mets and the David Wright update. So, Allison, you had a chance to actually watch the press conference, which happened earlier today as we record. How did that go? I didn't get to see it, so I'm, almost afraid to hear.
Oh, man, Chris, it was so rough. Like, I mean, he cried almost the whole time. And mostly when he talked about his wife and his daughters, he cried a lot. And that was just, it was gut-wrenching. I was at work, and my desk, I don't have an office that's, separate from everybody else. And it's not even, I have, a walled-off cubicle. It's, an completely open space. And I was just crying in front of all my coworkers.
Damn.
It was awful. And I was just like, it's just a Mets thing. I'm just in my feelings. It's fine. Just go do your life and let me be. It was bad because, just seeing him so broken up and knowing that he did everything he could to come back and he's just feeling like he can't do it. It was really, really heartbreaking to watch. Jeff Wilpon sitting next to him with, the completely expressionless face just made me so mad.
That feeling being in that spot of I'm emotional at work for something that nobody here can really relate to. That's
right.
That's something I don't know. It's something that few things can do other than the Mets.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think it's just. We all knew that this was coming, right? Eventually, at some point, someday. We all knew, and we've had a long time to mentally prepare for it as Mets fans. But it's one of those things, it's a cliche to say, but it's one of those things where it's nothing can actually prepare you for when it happens. Nothing can prepare you for when it actually happens. I thought I was ready, but I was not ready.
It's... it's tough. This is the guy who I think any rational Mets fan could look at and say, this is the best position player who's ever played for this team. And, he was a Met from start to finish, or he will have been a Met from start to finish.
Yep.
We've still got a tiny bit of future left on that career. And just in case anybody has been under a rock and only listening to our podcast and not, tuned into any other Mets news, if this is where you get your breaking Mets news, the summary was that basically David Wright will be activated for the final homestand of this season, aiming to play on September 29th, the Saturday game, the penultimate game of the season. And there's a chance he may play, in some other part of that homestand, but it'll depend on how he, how he feels and, the circumstances surrounding his body and the team and probably the weather, it just a little bit of everything. So we're going into it expecting one David Wright game send off and, maybe some other stuff, I think, if I got that correct.
Yeah, that's right. It's a swan song, basically. And it, like, and they, and I mean, he, even though we all knew what was happening, like, he didn't use the word retirement. And I think that that might have something to do with, like, contract stuff and, like, legal stuff. I'm not privy to the details, obviously, of that. But he skirted around actually using that word. But, you know, Steve Gelbs, I think it was, asked the very first question. I didn't get all the way through all the questions because I actually, like, stopped listening at one point to go buy tickets for the game because I was worried it was going to sell out, like, immediately. And it kind of did. Like, I was on SeatGeek and I kept trying to buy tickets and, like, it kept being like, those are sold out. Those are sold out. I tried like 10 different times and I was on the phone with my mom at the same time. And my mom was like, I'm on StubHub. And I was like, I'm on SeatGeek. And we, like, it took us a long time to actually get tickets. We finally did. We actually got them through the Mets because it got to the point where the prices were rising so quickly in real time that face value was a good deal by the time we were actually able to get through and buy them.
Yeah, so, that makes sense.
Yeah. So, but I missed, so I didn't see all the, I didn't hear all the questions, but I did hear the beginning of the question and answer bit. And Steve Gelb, I think was the very first one. And he basically said, like, he didn't use the word retirement either, but he said, I mean, just to be clear, David, this is it, right? And David basically said, yeah, I don't see, he basically said the circumstances of how I'm, I don't see myself continuing this season. So that was kind of like at that moment it kind of sunk into everybody, this is actually like a swan song and he's not coming back this year.
Yeah, no, that's as I'm looking at it, after not really having a chance, the ticket situation might be less ideal than I expected, but
yeah, like we'll see. On the broadcast, I was listening to the radio during game two of today's doubleheader. I was listening to the radio while I was walking the dog, and Wayne Randazzo said, because he's in for Josh Lewin, he said that the tickets were sold out. At least on, like, Mets.com, I assume. Obviously, you can still get them on StubHub for probably, like, exorbitant prices, but...
Yeah, it looks like the at the moment, the only thing on Mets.com is Metropolitan Platinum for $445 each. So
super.
You can probably do better than that on StubHub.
Yeah, I was hearing that standing room only was like $100 at this point. I was like, what the heck? Yeah, that's crazy.
Well, yeah, I'm not. So we had been sort of discussing on the podcast over and over. We've mentioned getting a get together in person at some point this season at a game, and as the Mets had gotten worse and worse, it kind of just was easier to put it off and put it off. And we had been looking at September anyway, so we were looking at the 30th before there was any concrete plan for David Wright. And I don't know, now I think it's just kind of going to be, if you're at the 29th, if you're at the 30th, we'll make it a point to have a meetup, standing room for either all or some of the game, on the field level. So,
yeah, I mean, I'll be there on the 29th for sure. And I'm debating about the 30th still. I may end up staying in New York and then, well, in New Jersey rather, and then also going to the game on the 30th, but I haven't decided about that yet. But I'm definitely going to be there on the 29th. So,
nice. Yeah. Yeah. So that, stay tuned on that. We, we kind of slacked and then we were about ready to be like, okay, let's just do the final game of the season. And, then this stuff came up, and sort of took over.
Yeah. And if the Amazing Avenue Slack is any indication, then like 90% of our staff is going to be there.
Yeah, yeah. So
I was like, is anyone going to be able to recap this game? We're all going to be there.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's, that's one of those that if it takes a little extra time, we can work on that a little bit later after everybody gets done processing all of it, but yeah.
It's been a day.
I mean, we will probably do an entire episode of David Wright retrospective, but, given what we know now, we're in a spot that I think we can begin to reflect on his career. So there are so many things that might stand out over the course of it. But do you have a top David Wright moment as a memory, or a top one or two, you know?
Yeah, it's hard to pick just one. I have a few. I know it's like he's had such a long career and there are so many, but now that I've like put some distance between, since he hasn't played in a while, and I've put some distance between myself and when he last played, like the 2015 comeback and that whole thing is up there now, I think, as like one of the top David Wright moments. For me, I think the slide across home plate fist pump against the Nationals is still just like one of the top Mets moments for me, period, let alone a David Wright moment, just because of everything that meant for him. And in addition to the Mets, I think that was, and just the whole timeline of that starting there. And then also during the playoffs, the home run he hit during the playoffs, the home run he hit in his first game back, and then the Nationals fist pump, the way he in game one, the like single he drove in a couple runs in the playoffs, and then the home run he hit, just everything of 2015 is like a top moment for me, for sure, that comeback that he had.
Yeah. And I mean the fact that ends in, you know, the World Series home run, you know.
Yeah.
That's up there for me, getting to be there and see David Wright hit a home run in the World Series. Obviously, I would prefer that it would have been a World Series victory in the end for the Mets, but
yeah, you know,
that was awesome.
Yeah, that was just so great. I think another one that's high up there on the list is a walk-off against Mariano Rivera. That's pretty high for me.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's nothing wrong with that.
That's definitely one of my top moments was that. And I just remember, like, because that was still a time when I was living at home, and I just remember, like, flipping out in my living room with my parents and us just, like, running around and, like, yelling and just, like, any memories that I have of the Mets of, like, still being at home with my family and, like, all of us celebrating as a family are special to me, and that was one of them. So there was that. Definitely the 06 playoffs are still high up there for me, too. And the role that David Wright played, he was so good that year, so good that year. And I know that we had like so many giants on that team when it comes to like Beltran, Delgado, like all the big boppers that we had on that team, that I feel like David Wright's performance kind of gets a little overshadowed sometimes. But he was so good that year and so instrumental in that playoff run that they had. So that's also up there. I think that like it's painful for me to know that he never won a ring. That's really hard. But I think the more time that passes and the more that I've like will be able to process this, I think the more I'm going to appreciate the two playoff runs he did have and how great they were. That's up there too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's, you know, just the overall, like the overall performance of his career, you know, even as he was starting to have issues that cost him a lot of playing time, you know, this was a guy who, when he played, he performed well, he always hit well, and, you know, it's just, you take it all together and it's, it's a career you can appreciate. And, you know, for me, it's funny. I asked the question. I don't even know if I have a clear answer of my own for it. But
yeah,
I think, you know, him celebrating. And at the time, at the time, Jose Reyes was just as exciting as he was. You know, that was that duo celebrating the division championship at Shea Stadium stands out. You know, the barehanded catch in, I think they were in San Diego back then, you know, that stands out. Certainly the World Series home run, you know, there was at least one All-Star game where he had a big hit, you know, just
yeah,
thing, all those kind of things, and
the home run derby at Citi Field. Yeah,
no, it's crazy how long ago that feels, and you know,
yeah,
it wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't, but it feels like forever ago.
Yeah, it's nice.
The Matt Harvey, David Wright duo, you know, at at Citi Field for the All-Star game, it feels like a different era almost. It was only 5 years ago.
Yeah, no, that it's nice when you have moments like that, because you know, all too often you go, oh, that happened, this thing that I'm thinking of happened last year or 2 years ago, and you look and it's like, no, that was 7 years ago.
Yeah, right.
You know, so it's a nice thing to kind of feel like wow, that was fairly recent in the history of baseball. So yeah, but yeah, it's tough. You know, this is a guy who, at the risk of getting into baseball cliches, just did things exactly how you'd want a player to do them and performed at a top level and, you know, was just a solid dude from all everybody can, you know, tell from where we sit. So,
yeah, I mean, all of his teammates that have ever played with him have nothing but great things to say about David Wright. He's one of the dudes in the league never heard a single bad thing about. And this is like, and unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, but this is an era now of us, you know, finding out more than we ever would before about guys and their past and things that they didn't think would come up. You know, between the like Josh Hader stuff and all the things that have like come up about different ball players that, you know, make you feel like, you know, damn, never have heroes, right? Because like it turns out that they're like all crappy people in real life. But it's like, even through all of that, no one has ever had a single bad thing to say about David Wright. And I think it's just, you know, there's like, for me, it's going to be hard to replicate that ever again for another player, the way that I feel about David Wright, because he came up in 2004. I was 14 years old. And so I feel, I mean, like, it's not like I'm young enough that I don't remember any teams before David Wright. I certainly do. I remember the Piazza, the Fonzie years. I remember that stuff. And all of those players are special to me. But, you know, when you're like a middle school kid, like that's kind of when the formative years of your fandom start, I feel like. And so David Wright was a constant presence during the formative years of my Mets fandom from age 14 until now. I'm almost 28. And so I feel like, you know, my entire teenage years and young adulthood, David Wright has been a constant presence. And that's something that I don't think can be replicated, even if there's another. I'm sure there will be other players, maybe not other players that spend their entire careers for the Mets, because that's becoming rarer and rarer now. But I'm sure there'll be other players that are as special to the franchise in the future. But nothing will be like David Wright for me. He's like how Tom Seaver was for my dad. And it's special.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I hope that we get some career Mets out of the current crop of players who are good. You know, and I guess that's a decent segue into, you know, the situation at hand with the team. Yeah, the bigger picture, it's hard to really put the team ahead of David Wright right now. Somebody who always yeah. did that himself. But it, you know, it's it, that Wright is just so incredibly the focus at the moment. And, you know, for a little bit, it distracts us from the reality that is the Mets. But, you know, if we're talking about who could be the next career Met and everything, what the Wilpons do with their choice for a replacement for Sandy Alderson is going to be a big part of that. You know, whether or not somebody like Jacob DeGrom or Noah Syndergaard or even Zach Wheeler, if you, you know, completely want to buy in to what he's done, if somebody like that can, you know, spend their entire career with the Mets. None of them are going to be David Wright, and that's, you know, that's not even an insult. That's just really hard to do.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, before the Wright stuff came out, we saw that ownership, essentially Fred and Jeff Wilpon, have differing opinions on how to approach the GM search and, you know, what to prioritize in it. Is there any hope for us?
I don't know. I mean, ultimately it's going to be Fred, not Jeff. It seems that Jeff is actually the one that wants the more analytically minded GM, and Fred is the one that wants the more like a baseball lifer type. This is going to sound like way more negative than I mean it to sound, and I'm sorry. And I really don't want to sound like I'm being like completely pessimistic about this, but I have reached the point where I feel a certain amount of indifference about who they pick to be the GM, because ownership is going to be the same. And I've kind of accepted the fact that not much is going to change about the Mets unless ownership changes, because it's just going to be the Wilpons micromanaging the team either way. And so I'm kind of like, is it really, like, let's say, you know, Jeff wins out and we get a more like newish school analytics type guy, which I think is something that, you know, the Amazing Avenue audience would favor more. Like, is it really a win if it's still just going to be like Jeff Wilpon running the team?
Right. Yeah. I guess from our perspective, it's not even, it might not even be a realistic ask, but the focus might not even be, okay, is this guy, I don't know, let's just hypothetically say the Mets hire the first female GM in team history.
Oh boy, I don't expect them to do that.
Yeah,
much.
No. I probably would be, I'd be extremely surprised if they do that. But let's just leave the possibility open for now and hope that they can surprise us in any way that's positive.
Right.
But yeah, so say they, you know, is the background scouting, is the background player development, is it, you know, analytics, is it some combination of those things? I would gladly take somebody who, you know, who you'd classify as any of those things.
Sure.
As long as that person actually gets to be independent and have a budget and run a team, you know, the Mets should not be stuck on a $140 million, $150 million ceiling for their payroll on an annual basis. But if they are, then, you know, I'd like to just say, hey, you're the new GM. And you have this budget, and we're going to step out of the way. I know, as I'm saying this, I know this isn't happening, but
right.
If somehow a candidate for the job seemed so perfect that he or she made the, you know, the Wilpons happy, then use that leverage to say, okay, I want a budget, and I want you to let me make decisions. And you can like them or dislike them, but you have to give me some time.
Yeah.
I don't see that happening, but that, if a person could convince them of that, I wouldn't care what their back. I want them to have a baseball background. I want them to know what they're doing, but I wouldn't care what they thought of analytics if they could just establish that and then move forward. Because, you know, the whole process, there's more than just the GM, you know, that's the person making a final call. But in an ideal environment, there's information coming in from, you know, both angles, and you know, then that person can make a decision. So I don't know.
I agree with you. Anyone that can rein them in is probably the preferable option, no matter who they are.
Right.
But I just don't see that happening. And it's just, I think that, like, I mean, like, you know, there have been good things and bad things about Sandy Alderson's tenure as GM. But I think one thing that's abundantly clear is that once he was, you know, removed from the picture, I feel like a lot of the dysfunction in the organization was laid bare for everyone to see. And, it, you know, until he left, you didn't appreciate how much he was released. Even though he wasn't given as much independence as I think most of us would have liked, you know, at least we could tell that he was, you know, keeping things under control such that it didn't seem like such a shit show all the time. But now it just seems like a shit show all the time. And part of that is that they don't have a real GM. But, you know, I'm like, we need a person who can handle that dysfunction and at least, you know, keep a lid on it. Because I think Alderson at least accomplished that.
Yeah. Oh, we're definitely seeing the difference between, you know, what he did and what,
yeah,
you know, what effect it had. You know, and as you look at it, you know, it's the perspective of Fred Wilpon, okay, you know, feeling that Alderson was too far in the analytics direction is... that's kind of ridiculous. Like, you know, it's
not, oh yeah, that's absurd.
Yeah. It's not that he, you know, I'm sure he took them seriously and considered them, but it wasn't like they went, you know, let's make an algorithm that runs the team. You know, they didn't go anywhere near the extreme of it. You know, so
I don't think anyone was considering the Mets in the top, even in the top half of analytic franchises in baseball. Like, the fact that they were saying it's too analytical is just, it's a joke, quite frankly, it's a joke. But, yeah, I mean, it's a strange time. It's definitely a time of transition for the franchise because we've got Sandy Alderson stepping down. We've got David Wright retiring. I feel like a proverbial torch is being passed to the next, you know, era of Mets baseball. It's kind of weird to think about. Like, it's hard to, you know, when you're in it with, like, we will easily be able to look back on this later and think about it, but it's kind of hard to think about it right now. But if you really think about it, we are entering a new era, because there isn't a clear... Not only do we not know who the GM is, but there isn't a clear, like, team leader successor to David Wright. Obviously, the Mets don't have to name a new captain. Like, most teams don't have captains, and the Mets went long periods without having a captain. But there's no clear person to sort of take the torch from David Wright. Is it Brandon Nimmo? Is it Michael Conforto? Is it, you know, is it one of the pitchers who are all, you know, reaching the point where they might not be Mets in a couple of years? Like, who is it?
Right. And Rosario maybe is, you know, at least had the potential to join that group.
Right. You know.
But yeah, those guys who are young enough, you know, it's weird. And I've always been, you know, slightly more interested in pitchers. But as great as a pitcher can be, they're just not out there every day. You know, it's just, yeah, just something about, like, that perception that, hey, you know, DeGrom and Syndergaard and Wheeler could be instrumental to turning this team around if things start to really go their way next year, you know? But there's just something about the guy who's out there every day, you know, playing 160 or 161 or two games every year and playing really well. You know, that's it just lends itself to a position player being that kind of face of the franchise, you know, team,
yeah,
leader, captain in the case of Wright. But yeah, right now, the only guys who are young enough to, you know, build up a track record that might somehow get them into that, you know, that discussion, I think, are those three: Nimmo, Conforto, and Rosario.
Yep.
You know, I hope Jeff McNeil is the best second baseman in baseball, but he's already 26 or 27. You know, like, that's
yeah,
not, that's not going to develop into that. And then nobody else who's young. And Segways are just writing themselves on this episode.
Yeah, right?
Pete Alonso's not up yet.
Alonso's not up yet. And as it stands, like, of those guys, interestingly, and obviously this isn't a prerequisite for being a team leader or anything, but of those guys that we discussed, Michael Conforto is the only one of them that ever shared the field with David Wright.
Huh. Yeah, that's crazy.
Right? Yeah. Like, Nimmo never played at the same time as David Wright did. Neither did Rosario.
Yeah.
And, of course, Hill did not. So it's just Conforto who's... Conforto is the only position player, like the only young, like, quote unquote core guy on the team who's not a pitcher who has played with David Wright, which is depressing to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, Conforto and Nimmo certainly stand out because they've had major league success. You know, Conforto's peak, I think, has probably been a bit higher than Nimmo's, but Nimmo's season is so far his peak. And it's been really, really good. And then Rosario, it's, you know, hey, we're looking at like a month or maybe a little bit more than a month, depending on, you know, how optimistic you want to be about everything. But is he finally, you know, getting into a groove and turning into this major league player who everybody thought he could be? But
yeah. And like, I don't know, like, I think that Ahmed Rosario's past month has been low-key one of the better things about this little nice run of baseball that Mets have been playing. Because, like, they've been playing a lot better in the sense that they've been playing watchable baseball lately, even in the games they've lost. They've been actually playing decent baseball, as opposed to compare that to June, where they were unwatchable, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of that has to do with the young guys performing. Shock, shock, when you play the young, good players, they play better. but Rosario has low-key been one of the best parts about it, because I think that a lot of people were way too soon to give up on him. He's so young, and he's incredibly raw in his talent. And I think that I'm a strong believer in him. I'm not saying that he, like, that for him to be successful. And I think that, and I wrote an article about this for Amazing Avenue, like, way back in May, when everybody was giving up on him after like a month, which was absurd.
But
like, I think that he, like, the bar has been set so high in baseball for these young shortstops. Like, he doesn't have to be Carlos Correa to be, or Francisco Lindor to be successful, like, to be a successful pick and a successful, like, you know, player. Like, I think that if he can just play like he's been playing for the past month and sustain that over a season, that's a 3.5 win player, and I'll take that all day long.
Yeah, and it's as good a time as any to point out that even Carlos Correa is showing that he's human this year.
Sure, sure, yep. Like, you know, he's not having the best season in the world. So, you know, it's a process. It's a process, and we have to be patient. We can't expect every prospect that comes up to be awesome right away. That's not how it works. We've been really spoiled with our pitching that
right.
A lot of them have come up and been, like, pretty great right away. DeGrom was awesome right out of the gate, and no one expected it either. Syndergaard was awesome right out of the gate. Mats had success right out of the gate. Wheeler had a lot of injuries, but now that we're seeing the real Zach, what I think is the real Zach Wheeler, like, this is pretty freaking good, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not always going to be that way. Like, there's a development curve. It takes time. And I think that, you know, I think that Ahmed Rosario playing the way he's been playing now over the whole season wouldn't have saved 2018, so it was a perfect time for him to go through, you know, some of the bumps in the road and, you know, develop. Hopefully next year will be a step in the right direction, and he'll be able to sustain the type of play he's had lately over the entire year. That would be a big, like, cog in the 2019 Mets being competitive as opposed to not competitive.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, with Correa, he's achieved a lot at the major league level. But this year is just a reminder that I think the cliche is that, you know, player development isn't linear.
Right.
You know, and that's I have no doubt that Carlos Correa is going to return to being an amazing hitter and overall player in this league. If not over the last couple of weeks of this season and postseason, then, you know, next year. And to be clear, he hasn't been terrible. He just hasn't been as good as his usual self. But it's just a nice reminder that, you know, sometimes it takes time. Sometimes even Mike Trout came up and struggled. And every time I say that, I feel like I have to throw in the disclaimer. I'm not saying that Amed Rosario is
going to be Mike Trout.
Mike Trout of shortstops. Just even the best player of all time, at least so far in his career, even that guy had a period of time where he struggled to adjust to coming up to the major leagues. So, you know, you got to just keep it in perspective and, you know, hey, if he can be that guy and, you know, turn into a potential all-star and all that stuff, that's a big piece of the puzzle. So I guess somebody who's we hinted at it, but one guy who's not a piece of the puzzle yet, Peter Alonso, whichever he prefers, he's not up. The Mets, based on a quote that he gave, he, you know, it sure sounds like they told him, well, it's a business decision.
Which you don't, I'm like, that was one of those moments where I just, like, when I read that, I just was like, Mets, you don't just say that. They just out and said it.
Yep.
Like, all right, well, here we are. They, like, flat out admitted that, like, he's ready to play in the major leagues and they chose not to promote him anyway.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot of justifications, and you might read things on other websites about the Mets that totally rationalize it. But, we're disappointed that that's the case. We're not surprised. And, you know, it sounds like Alonso's taking it all in stride. And
He's been very professional through the whole thing. He's admitted that he's disappointed, because who wouldn't be, but he's been very like, you know, I'm disappointed, but the Mets made their decision and I'm ready to give everything I have to show them that I can play at this level.
Yeah. And I liked that, you know, when they first said he's not going to be called up, I think the quotes he gave at that time were maybe a little more confrontational. And you had some reaction from some Mets fans of like, oh, who are you? You're not even in the major leagues yet. You got to earn it. Like, blah, blah, blah. Like, screw that. I love the idea of a prospect who has, you know, some hype, some stature, saying things that are somewhat critical of the way this whole system works. Because if the players union isn't going to do it because these guys aren't in the major leagues yet, then, you know, good for Alonso and anybody like that who's in that spot who says, you know, who calls it out a little bit. It's good to see. It's good to hear, I guess I should say. But
I like it too. And I mean, there seem to be like from the side of folks who aren't quite as outraged about this as we are, there seem to be two chief counter arguments to bringing up Alonso. And one of them, and I can refute both of them, I feel. One of them is, you know, the 40-man roster spot. That seems to be like a thing that keeps coming up. Like, there's going to be a 40-man roster crunch. And that was like the same. And the thing that like makes me laugh about that is that was like the same argument that people made about like David Wright coming back to. Now it's not an argument anymore because he's only playing for one game, basically. Maybe a pinch hit appearance here or there, whatever extra he gets to play. But like when there was talk of him being activated like right after his rehab assignment ended, people were like losing their proverbial shit over like a 40-man roster spot. And I was like, you seriously are quibbling about a 40-man roster spot when, like, the team is as bad as it is? I don't, like, there's so much dead weight on our 40-man roster. Like, that blows my mind that that is a consideration that you think is going to be an issue. Like, I can come up with, like, 10 spots off the top of my head. Like, going at, and I'm not talking about, like, immediately now. I'm talking about, like, going into next season. I can come up with, and that's a conservative estimate. That's, like, keeping some people around that we probably don't need to. Like, I can come up with, like, double-digit roster spots that will be available for next year. Just counting, like, all the folks that we need to keep on there and, like, even a couple of retreats that we probably don't need to keep on there. But, like, just the people that are going to be free agents and the people that we're not going to tender contracts and, like, the total dead weight there are, like, at least 10 or 12 spots that we can. And I'm not going to go through the entire 40-man roster. I'm not going to bore everyone with those details. Maybe I'll write a piece about it. But,
yeah.
There's so many people that are going to be free agents that are not going to be Mets, like, abundantly clear. Like, AJ Ramos is going to be gone, and, like, Jose Reyes is going to be gone. Please be gone. And, like other guys like that, like, there's so many rosters. Travis d'Arnaud is probably not going to get tendered a contract. Like, there are so many spots, and, like, Jack Reinheimer's on the 40-man roster, Drew Gagnon's on the 40-man roster, Jamie Callahan's on the 40-man roster. Like, do we really need all these dudes on the 40-man roster instead of Pete Alonso and David Wright? I really don't think we do.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely.
It's nonsense. So. It's nonsense.
Yeah.
And the other argument seems to be, you know, service time is the other thing that comes up a lot in these discussions, and that's clearly, like, a big motivation for the Mets to not bring him up. And that's kind of, I think, obviously the chief thing that Alonso and others that have taken issue with this are pushing back against, rightfully so. And my counter argument to that is, just because other teams are manipulating service time doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. And it doesn't mean the Mets should be doing it. Like, I know that Vlad Guerrero Jr., who's, like, a better prospect than Pete Alonso and is, like, going to be the next, like, Mike Trout, is, like, not here either. And, like, but the Blue Jays are also wrong, is my counter argument.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, no, for sure. And I think that all, you know, that sums it up. it's a reality of Major League Baseball that I hope changes.
Yeah, they have to do something about this, 'cause it's nonsense. I think it kind of started to blow up a little bit with Chris Bryant. It's, like, the first, like, real controversy I feel like I can remember. Do you think that's true? I feel like the Chris Bryant scandal was, like, the first time when people were really pissed about, like, the service time aspect, and it was so, like, blatantly obvious that that's what was going on.
Yeah, I think so. I don't remember. I mean, he was such a high profile guy. It was, like, much higher profile than Alonso is now, even.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, that sounds about right to me. So, yeah, it's, you know, I'm sure somewhere somebody will float, like, well, we started 11-1 last year, so if we just do that again, and then we can call him up when we magically think he's ready in the middle of April.
Oh, boy.
You know, I won't be surprised if we hear some variation of that.
Oh, yeah, me neither. It's coming.
But we'll see. We'll see. I don't know. Maybe in the last thing that we wanted to touch on, I think, even just briefly, but maybe the, you know, the person who replaces him will be able to, you know, get everybody a little bit more on the same page and a little bit less prone to leaking things. But Jay Horwitz is transitioning into a role. You know, he has spent a very long time in the one that he's in still today. But, you know, it's noteworthy at the very least, because it's just somebody who's been a mainstay in a, you know, significant position with the Mets over the decades.
Just another one of the, new era thing, passing the torch thing. I mean, Brian and I had a pretty extensive discussion on the pod a few weeks ago, the one where we talked about Players Weekend. So go back and give that a listen if you want to talk a little bit, if you want to hear us talk a little bit about Jay Horowitz, because we got a really good email from a listener. So that was kind of a prescient email that that listener sent. Maybe they knew something was brewing, who knows? But they asked about Jay Horowitz and how much, you know, he really is to blame or not blame for how bad the Mets have been at PR over the years. And is he really, you know, he might be kind of like washed up and done as far as his job is concerned. And, you know, it turns out that the Mets felt that he should be reassigned, and he seemed to, it seemingly was a mutual decision. Otherwise it wouldn't have happened. Like, it went out amicably, and like everything, he having a new board, it's all fine. But Brian and I talked a little bit about, you know, just how like the Mets have been poor at PR and branding, and, you know, not all of that is Jay Horowitz's fault, but he's certainly a symptom, I think, of a larger problem. And I'm at least glad that the Mets are, like, you know, on the surface moving on from that, even if it's not going to solve the dysfunction that's inherent in the organization with this current ownership group, at least, you know, they're, you know, trying a little bit to get some new blood in there as far as that's concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's, it'd be very interesting to hear everything. You know, we probably never will, but it would be interesting to hear everything that he had to say about what percentage was, you know, what percentage belonged to whom.
Yeah, Jay Horowitz's tell-all book.
Right.
You're going to wait for that.
Yeah, yeah, no, because it's, you know, I'm sure there were times that, you know, that you just couldn't get something killed. It was just like,
oh, nope. Yeah,
that person said that, it's too good, I'm using it, you know, like, I'm I'm sure there was plenty of that in his tenure, but at the same time, you know, it was a very long run, and you know, hey, we wish him the best in the new role, alumni relations, you know, something that you don't always hear with baseball, but if we're trying to look for, you know, some positive stuff about the Mets right now, you know, maybe that actually is something that could increase the focus on the history of the team and the former players. You know, if that's the sole focus, and he is, I think, famous for having these great relationships with players and reporters, you know, maybe we'll see a little bit more acknowledgement of Mets history, a little bit more incorporation of those former players, and you know, yeah, that would be a good thing, but I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, that would definitely be a positive development. I mean, you know, I think that the Mets, a weakness of theirs has been like embracing their own history. You know, we need, like, the fans needed to, like, borderline revolt before they, like, put Mets touches in Citi Field. It's kind of, like, seems like an obvious thing. So, like, hopefully having a, like, an alumni relations sort of guy to, you know, take care of those things will make that better. And, you know, what, you know, like, what better timing to have, like, your first, you know, strong relationship in David Wright. I mean, like, it's kind of a perfect storm. Like, David Wright announced his retirement, and now Jay Horowitz is transitioning into this role, and they already have what seems to be a really good relationship. So hopefully this leads to David Wright being, you know, involved with the team and being like an active ex-Met, as opposed to just someone that kind of fades into the background. And hopefully that means that they retire his number freaking immediately.
Yes. Yep. I'd be fine with doing it this season, but if not, you know, as soon as next year is totally fine.
Yeah, like, literally, he plays on Saturday, retire the damn number either that day or retire it, like, the next day. Do the retirement ceremony then. It's, like, the most obvious thing to do. And I like, that's one of those, like, me waiting for the other shoe to drop things. Like, I'm so nervous they're going to mess that up. And like, that would make me furious if they mess this up, because it's so obvious that they should retire his number. And if they don't, like, at the latest, like sometime next season, it's kind of like, Mets, like, I am so mad at you. Like, they better do it. They better do it soon.
I couldn't agree more.
Retire number 5. Do it now.
Yeah, it doesn't need to be as long a campaign as the Piazza one. So
yeah, seriously, like he's the best position player to ever play for your team, and he played his whole career with your team. It doesn't matter that he might not make the Hall of Fame. He probably won't make the Hall of Fame, even though he was on a Hall of Fame track before injuries took him down. But that does not matter. He's an all-time Mets Hall of Fame guy. So that should be all that matters. And I mean, I think that regardless of whether they, how long it takes them to act, like no one's wearing number 5 for the Mets ever again, even if it's not officially retired, but right. They should retire it.
Yeah. Yeah. And hey, on that note, I think we'll call it an episode. I don't know how we go out better than saying, retire number 5. So
retire David Wright's number.
Yes.
So, drop mic. Sign off.
with that, you can find us on Twitter. Allison is at PetitePhD. I'm at Chris McShane. Brian, even though he's off, I'll still throw his Twitter out there because you should be following. If you listen to this many episodes, if not, get on it. It's at Brian Needs a Nap. Whether or not you hear his voice in an episode, he's probably been involved in it in some capacity. So,
yep,
always worth recommending that you do the obvious and follow Brian. So, with that, we'll be back next week. Maybe we'll just keep being surprises on who's co-hosting each week. But yeah.
Hey everyone, this is Steve Sipa, and now that the minor league season is over, I just want to go over and review how each affiliate did in 2018, and I'll start with the top down, and we'll go over the Las Vegas 51s. So let's go back a little bit to 2017, and if you remember, the 2017 season was really bad for the 51s. They ended up with a 56-86 record, which is fourth in the Pacific Coast League Pacific Southern Division. And it cost Pedro Lopez and his coaches their jobs. And Lopez kind of seemed on the fast track for getting a look at, some major league coaching time, perhaps. If the 51s did a little better, maybe Lopez would have been hired for the coaching job that opened up with the Mets when Terry Collins retired instead of Mickey Callaway. But, what happened. And pitching was one of the main reasons why the team did so bad as they did. The 51s are either at or near the bottom of every pitching-related stat in 2017. As probably everyone knows, the PCL and Las Vegas in particular, it always favors hitters, and it's a hard place for pitchers to pitch. But the 2017 51s were particularly bad. And another thing that is in play here is that over the winter, it was announced that the Mets purchased the Syracuse Chiefs and that the team would be their AAA affiliate starting 2019. So, moving into a new stadium in 2019 with a new major league affiliate, team executives, 51s that is, decided to rebrand. So, the 2018 season would be the last that the Las Vegas 51s would be in existence. And before the first pitch was thrown, it did look like things were going to be better for the 51s in what was going to be their last year. The Mets hired Tony DeFrancesco to be the new manager, and he was a proven winner. He won multiple championships with the Sacramento Rivercats and with the Fresno Grizzlies over basically the last 20 years, so he was a good guy to have at the helm. On paper, the team looked like they were going to have one of their strongest pitching rotations in decades, at least... on paper. There was Zach Wheeler, Chris Flexen, Corey Oswalt, Mickey Janis and PJ Conlon. And it looked like that offense that would be helped by the environment was going to be supercharged by free agent sluggers Zach Borenstein and Bryce Brentz. But unfortunately, things happen. As the saying goes, the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry, and things definitely went awry. That rotation basically lasted a single turn before there were promotions and demotions, and guys got hurt, guys underperformed, and basically, by the time the All-Star break occurred in early July, the 51s were 42-48, which is 6 games of under 500. And that was actually good for them, because a couple of weeks earlier, and basically the low points of the season for the team, they were as many as 14 games under 500. The 51s were a lot more successful in the second half, and you can't say that their success in the second half was all because of this one person, but you can't ignore the fact that the 51s did a lot better in the second half, and Peter Alonso was promoted to the 51s in the second half. He hit .224, .367, .449 in 14 games in June. He hit .225, .311, .494 in 23 games in July. And he hit .308, .392, .731 in 27 games in August. His 20 home runs in 64 games that he played led the team during that period. They were pivotal in numerous wins, and no Alonso home run would be more pivotal than the one that he hit on Monday, September 3rd, the last game of the season. Down 3-2, the bottom of the ninth inning, Luis Guillorme hit a triple, and basically it looked like the Las Vegas 51s might be able to win their very, very, very last game. And then up came Alonso. Everybody knows what he can do. Tyler Beede, he threw a pitch that must have been a mistake, because if you look at if you look at pitch effects data, it was literally right down the middle of the plate. But Alonso, he swung and he smashed that ball behind the left field wall. He walked off the game and he ended the Las Vegas 51s game with a walk-off, and he ended the Las Vegas 51s franchise with a walk-off. So the Mets were, with the Mets and the Las Vegas 51s, they spent 6 seasons together from 2013 to now 2018. And during that time, the Las Vegas 51s had a record of 383 wins and 380 losses. And that translates to a 501 winning percentage. So it was overall good in Las Vegas. Obviously, all of those late night games are not good. But in terms of getting it done on the field, they won more games than they lost. And they made two playoff appearances, of course, in 2013 and 2014. Just looking at a month-by-month breakdown of how they did, in April, the team was under 500. They won 10 games and then lost 15. In May, they won 12 and they lost 18. In June, they won 16 and they lost 11, the first time they were over 500. Then in July, they won 14 and they lost 12. In August, they had their best month. They won 17 games and lost 12. And then in September, they won 2 and they lost 1. Now, if you look at all the players that played on the team last season, Patrick Kivlahan was the best hitter. In 98 games, he hit .314, .372, .588, which 29 doubles, 4 triples, 20 home runs, and 4 out of 7 stolen bases. The second best hitter was Peter Alonso, and in 67 games, he hit .260, .355, .585, with 19 doubles, 1 triple, 21 home runs, and 1 caught stealing. Arguably, Alonso would have been the best hitter if he played in more games, but Kivlahan played in about 30 more games than him, and he did have a bit higher batting average, though it was BABIP dependent. Kivlahan's BABIP was .361, as opposed to Alonso's, which was 284. Now, looking at pitchers, and this is a bit more subjective, but the best pitcher looked to be Drew Gagneau. He posted a 4.57 ERA in 157 and two-thirds innings, and he basically struck out a batter per inning. And again, because this is all very subjective, the second best pitcher on the Las Vegas team was probably Tim Peterson, the reliever. He posted a 3.49 ERA in 38 and two-thirds innings, saved a couple of games, and got a bunch of holds as a setup guy. So all in all, the Las Vegas 51's relationship with Mets was annoying because of, obviously, the time difference. But I'm going to miss them in a kind of strange way. It was always good, I guess, to have that kind of barrier, that time barrier between, you know, when their game started and when everyone else's, because it gave me time to recap everything else. And then I'd be able to go look and see, okay, finally, I could do Las Vegas now. And obviously, I'm going to miss Cosmo, who is their mascot, and he was a Jar Jar Binks ripoff. he looked basically like a Jar Jar Binks, a bootleg Jar Jar Binks that was gray. Obviously, the baseball alien logo is one of the tops in the minor leagues, and no more of that. And Russ Langer was a very, very good announcer. He was a radio announcer for the Vegas 51s, and I assume that he will be the radio announcer for whatever team is born from the ruins of the 51s. But it's a shame that the Mets, I'm assuming, won't be taking him east to Syracuse, because, again, he is a very, very good radio announcer, one of the best in the minor leagues. So those are your 2018 Las Vegas 51s. And I will be back next week to go over the 2018 Binghamton Rumble Ponies.
Hello, Mason Avenue listeners. Allison McCake here with another installment of the DeGrometer and the Nimometer, where we follow two of our favorite Mets, Jacob DeGrom and Brandon Nimmo. So we'll start this week with adding Mother Nature to the list of things that are conspiring against Jacob DeGrom this year. He was originally supposed to start on Sunday, but the Mets, fearing rain delays as it was raining during the game, opted not to start him and go with Corey Oswalt instead. Of course, that game went completely uninterrupted. The Mets won, and then the game the following day was rained out. So that forced Jacob DeGrom to start on Tuesday instead. He went seven innings against the Marlins and gave up two runs. Those two runs came on an infield single, a bloop single, and then a two-run double on which Austin Jackson took a bad route to the baseball. And not to say the ball wasn't hit hard, it was. A couple of unfortunate unlucky things, and then one, hard hit ball, and he was down 2-0. And that was all it took for DeGrom to take yet another loss. The Mets scored just one run before he left the game, and then they went on to lose the game 5-3. I'm sorry. Kevin Pilecki hit a two-run homer later in the game, but that was after DeGrom was out of the game. It was his 26th consecutive start giving up three or fewer runs, which snapped a 108-year-old record set by Leslie King Cole. Cole won 20 games that season, just to give you some context. The most DeGrom can win at this point now is 11, which, if he were to win the Cy Young, would be the fewest of any Cy Young Award winner in an uninterrupted season. Of course, the very next night, after DeGrom's start, the Mets scored double-digit runs again last night, as I record this on Thursday morning. It's getting to be almost like voodoo or like devil magic levels of weird at this point. It's kind of unbelievable. But at this point, you can only hope for, DeGrom breaking the win stat forever, because the worse that it looks for him as far as the Mets giving him nothing the more he will kill the win stat if he does win the Cy Young. Because imagine if he wins it with a losing record, how nuts that would be. His ERA did rise a little bit after the start to 1.71, but that's still well ahead in the league lead. Aaron Nola got smacked around a little bit by the Nationals in his most recent start, so his ERA is now up to 2.42, where Scherzer stands at 2.31. So DeGrom still has the ERA lead by 0.6 runs. DeGrom also leads the league in FIP with a 2.06, and he leads the league in ERA plus as well with a 216. Scherzer is second in the NL with a 186, so that's also a pretty substantial lead in that category. DeGrom has the edge over Scherzer as well in walks per nine innings and home runs per nine innings, but Max Scherzer has a lower whip and a higher K per nine, and he's pitched seven more innings than DeGrom, so that goes back to, you know, the fact that he had to wait a few days to start later than he had anticipated. So the fact that Scherzer will probably end up with more innings pitched than DeGrom may hurt him, may cost him in the end. But DeGrom has indicated that he's willing to pitch on short rest at the end of the season to go for the Cy Young and maybe get one more start in. So we'll see what happens there. As far as WAR goes, the same pattern remains, where DeGrom has a huge edge in Fangraphs WAR, but trails in Baseball Reference WAR. So DeGrom has 7.7 Fangraphs WAR, whereas Scherzer stands at 6.6 and Nola is at 5.3. Even after a couple of mediocre starts in a row now, Nola still has the edge in Baseball Reference WAR for pitchers, with a 9.2, compared to Scherzer's 8.9 and DeGrom's 8.3. It seems like it's really going to come down to the wire here for the Cy Young, and DeGrom's really going to face a big test in his next start if things proceed as planned, which with all the rain, who the heck knows what's going to happen. Mets are scheduled to play another doubleheader today, Thursday, and then open the series against the Red Sox at Fenway Park this weekend. And DeGrom is currently slated, provided no more weather events occur, currently slated to pitch on Sunday, matching up against Chris Sale. So that's a huge test in his Cy Young campaign to face off against the best team, probably the best team in baseball, super powerhouse offense in their home park with their ace on the mound, who's pitching, you know, who's going toe for toe with DeGrom this year as far as how well he's pitched. So, you know, that's going to be an exciting matchup to keep an eye on, and we'll see what happens. As far as Brandon Nimmo goes, he's been on absolute fire since coming off the disabled list. But this past week, he's cooled off a little bit from the absolutely torrid pace he was on before. That said, he still had a decent week at the plate. Most notably, he's back to drawing a lot of walks. In the past week, he's had 21 plate appearances and walked six times. So that's great. Back to the, you know, the hitter that he had been kind of before, despite being dropped in the order. It's unfortunate. He really should be higher in the order than he's been hitting. But the Mets really want Rosario to thrive in that leadoff spot, and he has done. So as a result, Nimmo has dropped down a little bit. But he's back to getting on base at a really high clip. During those 21 plate appearances, he also had three hits, two singles and a double. He scored four runs and drove in one run. That's all good for a 118 WRC plus for the week. On the season, Brandon Nimmo's had 464 plate appearances, over which he slashed 269, 392, 497. He's had 104 hits, 16 home runs, 44 RBIs, and 72 runs scored and 8 stolen bases. His 147 WRC plus on the season is only behind Paul Goldschmidt, Christian Yelich, and Matt Carpenter for the NL lead, and his 149 OPS plus is second only to Matt Carpenter for the NL lead. So he's up with the highest, you know, offensive producers in the National League, pretty much all of which on that list that are ahead of him are in consideration for the NL MVP at least. One extremely encouraging thing about the streak of better play that the Mets have been on lately, of course, outside of when Jacob DeGrom starts for some reason, it's the fact that the contributions offensively have almost all come from guys that are going to be keys for the future. Nimmo, Conforto, Rosario, and McNeil have been huge for this team the past few weeks, and it's been really fun to watch. All of them seemingly get a couple hits a day. It's been really awesome to see the young guys really pulling through toward the end of the season. It really gives you at least a modicum of hope for 2019 that all four of those guys will be fixtures in the lineup and be producing. So that's really an encouraging thing to see. And Brandon Nimmo's been a huge part of that. So that is all for this week. Hopefully next week I will bring you some good news out of Fenway Park from Jacob deGrom's start. We shall see. At this point, I'm not even concerned whether the Mets win games for him anymore. Like, I've just kind of accepted the fact that they won't. I just, A, don't want him to take losses, and B, want him to maintain the ERA lead. It's, like, really all I ask for at this point. Hopefully that shouldn't be too high of a bar to clear. So we'll see what happens. You know, it's, I think he's still in the lead for the Cy Young, as far as I'm concerned. Even taking into account how much these voters value wins, I think there are enough voters that see what DeGrom has done, and it's kind of hard to ignore. I think there are enough of them out there that value what he's done over, you know, simply wins and, you know, the slight edge Scherzer might have in innings pitched. I think that more and more people are starting to see how much the win statistic is nonsense. Because, you know, the Mets, even in the loss that DeGrom had, the Mets ultimately scored more runs than DeGrom gave up, and yet he still got a loss. Pitcher wins and losses make zero sense. Overall, so I think, you know, the tide is starting to change, and it would be really cool if not only DeGrom's season went down in Mets history, but also went down in baseball history as the thing that broke pitcher wins. That's really, after a miserable 2018 Mets season, you know, DeGrom breaking pitcher wins and David Wright playing baseball, the only two things I ask for. That's it. That's my wish list. It's two things. Anyway, I will be back in your feeds next week, and hopefully it'll be a good one.
Well, folks, that does it for another installment of Amazing Avenue Audio. Thank you so much for listening. We truly, truly appreciate it. Please go to AmazingAvenue.com where you can find all sorts of Mets news and information, including the details of our meetup, which should be coming up in just a day or two, being posted in a day or two, rather. The meetup will be the last weekend of the season. I know I'll be at both the Saturday and Sunday games. I believe we're going to go with Sunday for the meetup, but we shall see. If enough folks are already going to the Saturday game, maybe we'll do something at each one. I'm not really sure yet, but we will keep you updated for certain. You can also find Amazing Avenue on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Amazing Avenue. You can get this show directly from blogtalkradio.com, or you can grab it from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice. We ask that you please rate, review, and subscribe if you do so, because those help us quite a bit. And you can follow all of our contributors on Twitter. Even though I wasn't really on the show this week, I am still on Twitter at Brian Needs a Nap. Chris is at Chris McShane. Allison is at Petite PhD. And Steve is at Steve Saipa. So next time, we will talk about the Wheeler shutdown, the sort of general state of the Mets going into the last 2 weeks of the season, and whatever else happens to break. And so, until next time, let's go Mets.